Okay, next case for argument, Fufas versus Drew, Mr. Winter.
Your Honor, I believe the opposing counsel is in the hallway.
Well, he should be here.
May it please the Court, Richard Winter on behalf of the appellant Stanley Drew. Your Honor, this is a case involving the interpretation of a release which contains very broad language, and the issue is whether or not that broad language is undermined in some way by another document that was executed on the same date, but which, in my view, has nothing to do or in no way modifies the language of the release. The release is very broad. In paragraph 2 of the release, which was executed in January of 99, it states that the parties release each other from and against any and all claims, rights, debts, demands, acts, agreements, liabilities, etc., whether known or unknown. Paragraph 3 of the release says that the parties agree that the releases provided herein extend to all claims of every nature and kind. And in paragraph 4F, it says, each party covenants and agrees not to bring any action, claim, or proceeding against any party hereto directly or indirectly regarding or relating to the matters released hereby. And that same release says that the entire agreement relating to the matters and releases referred to in the agreement is contained in that release. Hence, I submit that by its terms, reading it plainly, it is a general release releasing all claims that existed between the parties as of the date of its execution, and it was executed in January of 1999.
Well, now, didn't the same judge approve the settlement or agree to enforce the settlement and also interpret it?
Yes.
We have cases which say that when a judge is interpreting his own order or agreement that he incorporated into an order, as here, we give him a lot of scope. I mean, he knows it a lot better than a judge. A judge ordinarily doesn't know a contract particularly well because it was drafted by parties who are strangers to him. But if he approved it, then he knows he's like a party.
But
know what it means.
Your Honor, but he's not approving the settlement agreement that he presided over.
Nope.
In 1998, there was a settlement agreement reached between Mr. Fufas and Mr. Drew, and there was documentation created to that effect. That's a 98 document. It's a 99 agreement with this, which the trial court had nothing to do with, that's at issue here. So the trial court was not interpreting what he had done in 98 and determining whether or not it should be enforced. He was called upon to interpret a January 1999 agreement, which was executed after the settlement, and whether that agreement and the release language of that agreement had an effect on the 1998 settlement.
Right, well, he's enforcing the settlement.
No, he's interpreting. No, it's not a question of that. It's whether he doesn't say at any point that I'm interpreting the settlement agreement and holding that I'm going to enforce it. What he says is I'm looking at the January 1999 release and evaluating the impact that had on a settlement. No one disputes the fact that if the language of the release is interpreted as I say it should be, that is, that it's a general release, that the 1998 settlement agreement is abrogated.
Was there litigation pending in 98?
Yes, in 98 there was litigation pending in this court between Mr. Fufas and Mr. Drew.
In the district court?
In the district court, and that gets settled in the night before trial, and an oral settlement agreement reached. And that settlement agreement says...
It's submitted to the court as a part of dismissal of the case?
Yes. And then at a later point in time, Mr. Drew says, well, I don't want to abide by that settlement agreement.
Yeah, but the court agreed to enforce the settlement agreement.
But that's not what's at issue in this appeal.
Wait a second. The court agreed to enforce the settlement agreement. It's like a consent decree, equivalent to a consent decree. And now, isn't what he's done what is under appeal? He enforced the decree, saying that this later agreement didn't abrogate it.
Absolutely not. He is not saying.
What's his judge? What is the judgment?
The judgment is denying.
But your client owes FUFAS, right?
Right. The judgment.
Okay.
Is
now, isn't
that
judgment based on the original settlement agreement?
True. And the question is, however.
Pardon? It is based on that.
It is. Right. But the question is not whether the settlement agreement was enforceable. The question is whether an intervening release releases a settlement agreement, which, for the sake of argument, I'll concede was enforceable, was valid, was between FUFAS and Drew and obligated my client to pay $275,000. But now you have a completely different intervening event, an executed settlement agreement.
Well, the judge had to decide whether this intervening event canceled the settlement agreement.
Absolutely. Simply
by which he had been a party, in effect.
Absolutely. But the question that, in his mind, the correct question.
Right, you're saying this agreement you're relying on wasn't approved by the judge.
No, it wasn't. It was a.
Okay, that's a fair point.
Intervening event, and.
But your position doesn't really make a lot of sense, does it?
I believe my position makes perfect sense, Your Honor. In that,
it's a kind of
again, no
literalism
one
about the 99 agreement.
But really, that's not a question in dispute. No one, not
what's
not,
the sense of it? Why would FUFAS have given up the agreement?
Because the parties had a long, long history of business dealings together, and as indicated in one of the whereas clauses, at some point prior to the execution of the 1999 agreement, the parties settled their business differences, and that's not an uncommon event. There was millions of dollars passing back and forth between these individuals.
What
millions.
Was the business involved?
They both were managing Indian tribal casinos, and so there was a lot of cash coming out of those entities, and they had a long history of business dealings, a long history of acrimonious business dealings among themselves, and so I don't find it unusual at all that in January of 99 they entered into a mutual general release in which they released all claims against each other.
But nevertheless, was the same magistrate judge involved in the original litigation?
Yes, the 98 agreement, but there was no magistrate judge involved in the 1999 settlement or 1999 release. That is an event.
I understand that, but okay. Then he's called upon to make an interpretation of this.
Of the 99 agreement, yeah.
Agreement. Knowing the background of the people involved in it.
Knowing the background of the people involved, and I would submit, Your Honor, that is why he engineered a decision the way he did. If he was interpreting this contract strictly based on the language of the agreement, which he should do, he would have held that this is a general release, and it released the settlement agreement that had been reached in 98. But instead, I think he probably is thinking to himself, well, this doesn't seem fair to me that I went to all this trouble to engineer a settlement agreement in 1998, and now because of this document, I've got to undo all that. But,
Well, on the contrary, the easy way out for the judge is to say the settlement agreement has been abrogated. Then he doesn't have to do anything ever again in this litigation.
Yeah, perhaps. I guess I was there. I viewed it a different way, Your Honor. I think that he should not have been influenced by the fact that he was involved in the earlier case, and he should have just interpreted the language of the 1999 agreement.
Well, the 1999 agreement refers to the parties have sold the entirety of their interest in their business venture. So that's a reference to a specific venture.
It is. But
that's what they're settling.
Well, let me make a couple points about that. That's the logic that the trial court adapted. But there's a couple problems with that. First of all, the sale agreement that he makes reference to has FUFAS and Drew on one side of the sale and an Indian tribe on the other. It's not a document which on its face resolves disputes between FUFAS and Drew. So to say that somehow that sale document limits the scope of the broad release language is illogical. And second, there's a reference in this whereas clause to other disputes between the parties other issues between the parties other than that particular purchase and sale agreement. It makes reference in the whereas clause to the fact that on January 1 they resolved their differences. But I don't think that there's anything in the sale agreement itself which would suggest that it was meant to limit the general release language. Let me make this other point. Every release I've ever been involved with every case, always makes reference to the fact that whereas the parties were involved in X versus Y and the parties' desire to settle that case, and every release I've ever been involved in then goes on to say the parties release all the claims they have against each other, whether known or unknown. And I don't think it would behoove public policy for courts to say, well, look, even though there's broad release language, the fact that you made reference to a specific case that was settled as part of that release means that it had a very, it was, the release was limited to the facts involved in that particular case. And in fact, that was the holding of this court, or the point that this court made in the case called Kaposi versus Kertazi, which is 183 Fed 3rd 629, which indicated that that type of interpretation would discourage settlements. I see my time is up at this point.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Winter. Mr. Keck?
May it please the court. I am Robert C. Keck, Jr., attorney for Appley Plato Foufis in this case. You're absolutely correct that this was, that Judge McKeague was enforcing a settlement agreement that he entered in 1998. It was adopted in his presence. That agreement had two essential provisions to it. Number one is, with respect to a management agreement that the parties had had with the Lummi tribes in the state of Washington, Mr. Drew was ordered to pay $275,000 within 3 years. With respect to a management agreement that the parties had with the Sequan tribe in San Diego, California, the order was that the parties were to split 50-50 any future monies that were received from that tribe. In January of 99, Mr. Drew advised Mr. Foufis that the Sequan tribe was prepared to pay the management fees that they were owing, and Mr. Foufis went out to California. They got the money from the Sequan tribe. It was understood that there would be a future monies coming. They entered into these agreements, and one of those documents, there were three documents adopted at that time. One was an agreement with the Sequan tribe regarding the sale of their business. The second was a side letter in which they agreed to split future monies received from the Sequan tribe, and also Mr. Foufis would invest $60,000 in a residence. And third was this settlement agreement and general release, which they are relying on now to set aside the judgment. Now, the essence of this is that Judge McKeague, in knowing all of those things and looking at this document, could look at it and see that the whereas clause is contained in here, and paragraph one talking about a sale of business interests clearly related to the dealings in January relating to the Sequan tribe. There's nothing in here that refers in any way to the 1998 settlement agreement or the agreements, the prior dealings regarding the Lummi tribe. He then looked at the law in this case, which they did not contest in the trial court, and which was clear both in California and Illinois, that if there's a general release, but it has recitals to specific transactions, an automobile accident, a stock transaction, whatever, that the general release is limited to those referenced items. That law is clear in California. We've cited a number of cases on it. The judge adopted that law, relying specifically on the California Supreme Court's decision in Hayes versus Weatherby. The California statutes relating to interpretation of contracts agree. Illinois cases have long been in accord with this principle. Mr. Winter says to you today that he somehow thinks all of this is against public policy, and he's asking you to make a monumental decision that all this law in California and Illinois is no good. But the law is very clear, and they didn't even bother to contest it in the trial court. So what the judge did was, he said, I take that principle, I look at this release, and I see that there are recitals, specific reference to the sale of business interests, and clearly talking about the disbursement of future monies to be received, and clearly related to the Sequan dealings and not the Lummi. And he said, therefore, under the law, the scope of this release is limited to the Sequan dealings and does not affect the 1998 settlement, does not affect the party's prior dealings with respect to the Lummi tribe management fees that came in.
Well, it affects a part of the settlement, though.
I beg your pardon?
The Sequan part of the settlement is affected, isn't it?
The agreement with the Sequan tribe?
The 1999 agreement does affect the second half of the 1998 agreement.
It does. It affects the 50% future fees to come in from the Sequan tribe. And he said that it does affect that, but it's limited to that. And that was his ruling based on the California law and that we set forth here. The release itself says that California law is the applicable law, and that's why he relied on that clear line of authorities. And
I was unclear about the relationship between FUFOS and DRU. Now, FUFOS operates casinos?
The parties formed a company called First Astry Corp in the late 80s, and it obtained a management contract with the Sequan tribe in San Diego. And they constructed a casino there for the tribe and managed it. Under the federal laws, you can only have a 7-year management contract. They ran into disputes with the tribe, had to sue the tribe, and then they, and that's why even in 98,
the Sequan tribe.
And that's why there was, when the 1998 settlement was agreed to, they knew that it was unknown how much money was going to come in from the Sequan tribe thereafter. And they didn't learn that until January of 99. And it was at that time that they went out and did their deal with respect to that Sequan money.
So they're both in the casino management business, and they had this joint venture that terminated.
They also had a second company called First Astry Corp. II, which went up and did a management contract with the Sequan tribe in the state of Washington, Bellingham, Washington. And that management agreement and the funds owed on that were resolved at the time of the 1998 settlement agreement, and therefore Mr. Fufas was waiting for his share of the monies that DRU had received from the Lummi tribe. So
the Lummi tribe's in Washington.
The Lummi tribe is in Washington. So that was what the $275,000 related to. The initial 1995 lawsuit was brought by Mr. Fufas saying, you, Mr. DRU, received money from the Lummi tribe, and you failed to split it with me pursuant to our prior agreements. And the $275,000 represented that failure of Mr. DRU to pay Mr. Fufas his share of the money that DRU had received from the Lummi tribe. When the settlement came down, there was still the Sequan issue was still pending. They didn't know how much they were going to get from Sequan, but Mr. Fufas was concerned he may pull the same thing on me again, and therefore I wanted in this agreement ordered by a federal court that he's going to pay me 50% of what he gets. And that's why those two matters were embodied in the 1998 settlement. Mm-hmm. So our position is that the law is clear. In the final analysis, this really is, as you were discussing, a question of abuse of discretion. Did Judge McKeague abuse his discretion in this case? First of all, there's no dispute on the facts. So he clearly, nothing in his opinion is identified as a failure to understand the facts. He clearly applied California law correctly. So there's no failure to apply law here. They're not even arguing that, except that they ask you for public policy reasons to change the law. So the question is, when a judge is looking at these things, he has to make a decision. And he knew all the facts. He saw these documents, and he made that decision. And we say that there's no reason to say that Judge McKeague abused his discretion in this case, and therefore his decision should be affirmed.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Mr. Winter, your time expired, but we'll give you a minute. Did it expire? Yeah, but we'll give you a minute anyway.
Okay, there's nothing in California law which suggests that what Judge McKee did was correct. This Hayes versus Weatherby case, 1882, involving the language of a conveyance of a grantor's right in certain property and an undivided interest, has nothing to do with releases and limitations. Second, it's not an abuse of discretion issue. It's a question of law, the interpretation of these agreements.
What is your public policy argument?
Well, it's the point that was made by this court before when it was interpreting in the case of Kaposi. I'm not asking you to create public policy. I'm asking you to acknowledge the public policy you already have acknowledged, in which, in that case, you're interpreting a settlement agreement, and a party settles a claim. There's a general release, and it says, I settle all claims arising out of this set of circumstances and any other known and unknown claim. And then he comes back and says, well, gee, I really didn't mean to settle all my claims. Here's one that I should be allowed to pursue. And this court enforced the language of the release, and it said it would undermine the process of fostering settlements if you were to allow parties to come into court and say, well, gee, I signed a general release, but I didn't really mean it. And
no, so
it's your
you can
policy.
Certainly argue that both ways. If you give these releases unlimited scope, you're certainly going to discourage releases. Also, what you said, I thought was key. You said arising from the circumstance, precisely. I mean, the defendant wants a general release, but if it's a general release for anything arising out of the circumstances that have given rise to the settlement. So the circumstances here were these dealings with regard to the Sikwan tribe, not the Lumni tribe.
Well, that is something
so what
that
you said. I mean, your argument that general release part of the 1999 agreement should somehow have been qualified. Is that it?
It says.
Well, how would Fufas protect himself against losing a totally unrelated claim? This $275,000 arising out of a different transaction altogether.
By simply adding the words, and the record shows he's a lawyer, to the effect that, except that it does not discharge the $275,000 owed by Standhu to Plato Fufas. I mean, this mutual.
Well, that would be misleading too, because what if there are other disputes between them? You see, the problem is, a release doesn't say whatever potential future past disputes we have are being discharged. That would be ridiculous.
This one says that.
Fufas might not even know what. No, all releases are general for obvious reasons, but they're all implicitly, or here with these whereas clauses, maybe explicitly, they're tied to a particular set of circumstances.
Yeah, well, I would submit, Your Honor, that again, my experience has been that in any case.
And what if Drew punched Fufas in the eye?
Those
is that released also?
Absolutely.
You're saying it is released?
Oh, absolutely.
All right, well, yeah, at least you're logical.
No, I mean, every case I've ever worked on, that mutual release language is included with the expectation.
Yeah, but it can't mean that, right? It can't cover unknown, unrelated assault.
I would suggest that the holding in Carposi versus Cortazzi of this court would suggest
it said that, was it? It said assaults are encompassed within a commercial release?
No, not specifically, but it said all claims, whether known or unknown, are encompassed by the release.
Okay, well, thank you very much, Mr. Rinter, Mr. Keck. Next case.